Because of listeners like you, Preborn has helped to rescue over 67,000 babies. Your $28 to sponsor one ultrasound doubled a baby's chance at life. Your tax-deductible gift saves lives, so please join us in this mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning and happy Friday. Today is Friday, April 11th, and we are back to our regularly scheduled programming after 3 days of Share-a-thon. And thank you so much to everyone who has been part of our AFR family, and for new givers and old givers and people who have been giving for so long to this ministry. We're so grateful for you. And if you are still wanting to give a gift and participate in our spring Share-a-thon, you can give online at AFR.net, and we so appreciate you for that. And we are back to the news. So, of course, the big topic is Trump's pause on tariffs and how exactly he's going to negotiate the art of the deal over the next 90 days that he has suspended tariffs for everyone except China, which is very interesting. That emphasis, of course, likely from trade advisor Peter Navarro, who I worked with in the first term when I was on the campaign. Actually had a lot of interaction and with Peter Navarro and kind of his viewpoint on China. So that's always fascinating to me to see kind of where the administration moves with Trump, of course, as the leader, the decision maker, but he has advisors around him, and he has advisors who have their own viewpoints and their own advice that they're providing to the president. So let's welcome in Paul Teller, who is the executive vice president for Advancing American Freedom, and also worked in the first Trump administration, so is no stranger to that dynamic and how all of that works. And good morning, Paul. So, was this pause, was this surprising to you, or how do you view this in the overall goal of how the administration and Trump specifically is looking at trade?
Absolutely. Well, as always, thanks for having me. Great to be back. I think what this strikes me is just it speaks to President Trump's style of decision making. And I know many of the media don't like to admit this, but he does have different voices around him with different opinions. And he likes to hear them out, sometimes at the same time in the same room, which is always interesting. But for example, you just mentioned, Peter Navarro is on one side of the trade dispute or trade issue. And you've got, for example, Kevin Hassett, in the National Economic Council. He is, or Council of Economic Advisors, I forget which one he's in, but one of the economic divisions of the White House. And he's more on the other side, much more of a free trade or free markets kind of guy. And they're both, important forces in the White House. They were in the first administration, and they are now. And he's listening to both. He's also, susceptible to public opinion and folks that he cares about right around him, feeding him that public opinion. And I think this speaks to that style of decision making, that he doesn't just kind of listen to singular voices and make decisions in advance and then just have yes men kind of say it. It's like, no, he's got different folks right around him. So here we go. I think we're seeing it, in real time.
Yeah. And it's really interesting to see how the market then has rebounded and, is so fickle, and how the left, I think this is taking away their biggest talking point of, oh, this is going to be headed toward a recession, and look at all of the wealth that Trump is just taking away, and you can't trust him and all of these things. So, where does the narrative for Trump, but then also for the leftist media that hates him, where does this change the strategy in terms of the PR game?
Well, and it's a good question, because let's face it, we still don't know exactly where this is going to end up, right? Because I think he did say, well, he wants to keep that across the board 10% tariff for most countries. So that's not so great for, those of us in the more free market perspective, that kind of thing. But it looks like he took away some of the higher tariffs for many countries. He's very clearly signaled to the markets yesterday that he is open to negotiation, open to eliminating tariffs, at least lowering them, and not necessarily just using them willy-nilly as a weapon. So that is I think why you saw the market rally, why people kind of reversed their recession forecast that they had made, right? Bloomberg, I think, and others were saying, okay, now we're going to operate off of a baseline that we're going into a recession. And yesterday it said, oh, no, just kidding. We're going to backtrack that now because, you know, without the extreme tariffs, the American economy could soar, especially with tax reform. Getting certainly done this year. I know there was a little blip in Congress yesterday. We could talk about that if you'd like, but there will be tax reform this year, no question. It'll definitely get done.
Wow, that's really fascinating and a great prediction. And I know that a lot of Americans, especially who've been feeling the stress of the economy and the markets and all that, are looking for the campaign promise on lowering taxes. And some economists have suggested that it's really not a possibility, or maybe it's mutually exclusive, a possibility to follow through with everything that Trump wants to do with tariffs, but then also reduce taxes. So do you see that as mutually exclusive policy outcome, or how could Trump navigate the waters that he can get both of those things done with a better trade economy for the United States, but also reducing taxes?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one thing we've been saying is, like you just pointed out smartly, is focus on tax reform. And, you know, what that means really is extending the existing, you know, Trump-Pence Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, you know, the Trump tax cuts from last time, make sure they stay as they are now because they've benefited everyone across the income spectrum. And if they go away, they will hurt everyone across the income spectrum and every small business as well. So do that. But we've been saying from Advancing American Freedom and some others allied with us, go further. Further cut taxes. Why just keep things as they are? Let's cut business taxes further, for example. Make it even more attractive to open a business, expand a business, invest in a business, bring a business from overseas over to the United States and do operations here. That's, I think, also how President Trump could accomplish some of the things he's trying to accomplish with the tariffs, right? Because you hear him and advisors always saying, we need to do these tariffs so that there's, you know, more manufacturing and other jobs and you know, production in the United States. Well, what's a great way to get more jobs and production in the United States? Make it cheaper to do it in the United States. How do you make it cheaper? Lower taxes, lower regulation, things like that. So I think he could absolutely pursue this, you know, more free market, lower government path and get the outcome that he wants without doing these kind of punitive, excessive tariffs on allies, on folks that we are, you know, great trading partners with.
Mm. Yeah. And so, I mean, do you think that this will damage the relationship at all with some of these countries? I mean, obviously, Trump has been pretty bold and very Trumpian in what he's talking about. And I'm speaking with Paul Teller, by the way, who's the executive vice president at Advancing for American Freedom. And he was formerly in the first Trump administration, so has, you know, a lot of perspective on this. Will this damage our trade negotiations with any partners like in the EU and all of that? Or is this really just about America first policy and saying, you know, hey, let's make things fair, but bringing back manufacturing to the United States? That was such a big part of his first term and wanting to emphasize America first. So maybe he doesn't really care necessarily about about the impact on trade relations because, hey, we're America.
Right. And the, you know, the beauty of this president is I don't think he rolls out of bed every morning and thinks, you know, do the Europeans like us today? You know, gosh, you know, what do some of the Central American countries think of us? Right. He thinks about America. And if other countries, other regions of the world do like us, that's all the better. It's a plus. It's gravy. You know, the cherry on the sundae, all the analogies you can come up with. But it's not primary. And I think that's a huge difference, for example, from the last administration, right, where you get the impression that Biden and Harris did wake up in the morning to the extent Biden even knew what he was doing in the morning, but, you know, woke up in the morning and said, oh, my God, I don't know if the Europeans really like us today. What could we do so that the international community likes us more and respects us more? And so glad that President Trump does not feel that way. So I actually think that this probably won't do any long-term damage to trading relationships or other relationships. Mainly because at least so far it seems like this is kind of a short-term play with the tariffs. In other words, if these really had stayed, you know, gone into effect and stayed and stayed and stayed and stayed and, you know, was destroying economies and really hurting businesses worldwide and, of course, in America, yeah, then, of course, you're seeing damage to relationships. But the fact that I think it's short-term, you know, our partners, I believe, are looking at this as a wake-up call. Like, hey, this was the way that President Trump felt. He needed to alert the entire planet that we're on to you. You know, you are not being fair trading partners, and we're going to force some changes with a little bit of tough love. So I think that's right.
Yeah. Well, you know, as they've said, you know, daddy's home when there's tough love. We're no longer under, you know, the weak kind of feckless Biden administration that everybody just gets to, you know, walk all over the emotional blah, blah, blah of the Democrats. So certainly things are changing in Washington. But what about, you know, everything else? I mean, it seems like the leftist media can only focus on one thing, and generally they choose specifically one thing that they think is most damaging to Trump. And so previously it was Doge and how, you know, Elon Musk is this unelected bureaucrat, which is hilarious because every presidential appointee is by definition unelected, but that's kind of the point, right?
Exactly.
So that was so ridiculous. And then we have, you know, his immigration stuff and how dare he actually deport violent gang members and all of the judicial activist stuff. Now we've been through the tariff thing, and this is only a couple of months into the administration.
Yeah.
So we're in for a long haul. But where, in terms of Trump's campaign promises and maybe some unfinished business from the first term, do you see the administration headed after, you know, kind of the in this 90-day period where we're just, you know, waiting on some of those outcomes?
Well, I think really probably the biggest thing to focus on, and to answer your question, is cutting federal spending, right? Mm. And as much as I hate to admit it, that was, not one of our top successes of the first administration. We did try. If you look at some of the budgets the president sent up to Congress, they cut, you know, mandatory spending, meaning like the spending that's on autopilot. They proposed cutting discretionary spending, which is the spending, you know, appropriations bills, the things that Congress does every year on an annual cycle. All kinds of big proposed cuts. What did Congress do with them? You know, crumpled up the paper, threw it in the trash, and increased spending, even with Republican majorities. So that, unfortunately, you know, didn't go well the last time we had Trump in the White House. I think he's learned that lesson. The people around him have learned that lesson. That's why you've got Elon Musk, Doge, Russ Vogt at OMB, and just others who are just absolutely 100% fully committed to actually doing real spending cuts. And that's why you saw this week some House conservatives and even some just regular House Republicans saying, hey, what the Senate is proposing to cut as a minimum, because, you know, to get through this fancy reconciliation process, which is the accelerated process of tax reform and spending cuts needed to avoid a filibuster in the Senate, to go through that process, you have to set, like, spending cut targets and basically minimums. So, like, the Senate said, I will cut a minimum of $4 billion. And it's like, oh my God, $4 billion you can almost find in the sofas here in Washington, D.C. You know, the House set a minimum spending cut level of about $1.5 trillion, much bigger number. Now, of course, our friends in the Senate are saying, wait a minute, that's just a minimum. We're going to actually cut much more than $4 billion. The comeback to that is, well, if you're going to do it, why don't you say that in your, you know, in the process that you have to set up? You have to put that number down on paper. Why don't you put a higher number on paper? And they can't really give a good answer yet. So that's what's going on in Congress now. That's just trying to get the Senate to a point where they will admit in writing that they will do real spending cuts. And, you know, it's an uphill battle, but we're gonna be there and keep pushing it.
Yeah, and I'll ask the maybe not quite as MAGA popular question, but, you know, we know that Congress isn't a fan of spending cuts because they love to spend our money. But looking at the first term, do you think that Donald Trump is himself actually a fan of spending cuts when the deficit was increased under his first term? And even though, yes, Doge is looking at all of this, is that actually, do you think, genuinely a priority for him?
You know, I think it is. I'll admit that in the first term, maybe he didn't necessarily understand the power of spending cuts to the way that we as his staff should have convinced him of it. I think he sees it now. I think he sees, first of all, the political popularity is much more now than back then. But more importantly, he realizes, you know, if you do spending cuts and you kind of recede government out of people's lives, that's another great way to, you know, soar the economy, right, to get inflation under control, to let people keep more of their own money, make more of their own choices, make more of their own investments, and just be happier Americans and do an America First agenda. So I think he's seeing now the connection between spending cuts and the America first agenda. So I do believe he sincerely feels it now. You know, again, we did try the first term. We did send proposed budgets to Congress. You can cut this, and they ignored it. Unfortunately, they also dropped, you know, last-minute omnibus bills on President Trump's desk where it's like, take it or leave it. In other words, either you sign this thing with a, you know, political gun to your head, or you could veto it, but then the government shuts down and we blame you. So he was just in a terrible position so many times during that first term. We seem to have learned that lesson as a political class, as Republicans, and I don't think that'll happen this go around.
Really interesting insight, Paul Teller. I appreciate you sharing that. And I think you're absolutely right that, you know, he came in the first term as an outsider, where now he understands a lot more, having been there, done that, and then, you know, suffered through all of the other drama that, you know, happened in the 4 years under Biden, and now finally coming back. I think, like anybody, you know, there is a learning curve to something new, and he's definitely going in with eyes wider open, for sure. And in the last few minutes I have with you, I'm speaking of Congress. I also want to turn to the SAVE Act, because I know this has been a priority for advancing American freedom as well. And, you know,
absolutely.
Speaking of making sure we have good conservative policy, that starts with our elections, so that we, the people, actually have safe and secure elections. And so the SAVE Act is something I think that Congress should pass. I've had Representative Chip Roy and, you know, a bunch of others on this program to talk about it. So from your perspective, why is this so important?
Oh, absolutely. And that's something that your listeners should, like, just absorb this for 1 minute. So do you know it is not against federal law for a state to register illegal aliens to vote? I mean, just let that soak in for a minute. So in other words, it is against federal law for the actual voting. You know, so illegal aliens are not supposed to vote. That's against federal law. But they can actually still register to vote. And it's like, what? Right? Like, how could that be allowed? How is that logical? How is that possible? Especially because you know how these things work. If somebody's registered to vote, they're on the voting rolls. They walk in. Hi, I'm Joe Smith. I'm registered to vote. And the, you know, kind person volunteering and sitting at the desk at the polling place looks it up, sees the person on the voting rolls, and it's kind of hard to say no and isn't right there going to check whether the person is an illegal alien or not, is a U.S. citizen or not. So then you let the person vote. So finally, some smart folks realize, my God, we can't let them register to vote either. It's not just the voting itself, but you shouldn't even be on the voting rolls in the registration books. And so the SAVE Act would make it a federal law. No state would be allowed to register illegal aliens. Total common sense. 80%, 85%, 95%, or 90% or so in various polls of America agree with this. And so we're just gonna push it through, get it done. We'll get some Democratic opposition, of course, because they're going to say it's voter suppression, but all it is suppressing the votes of people who are not supposed to be voting. So that's super common sense, and it looks like we're getting it done.
Yeah, it is super common sense. And of course, you know, the Democrats are always like, oh, this is disenfranchisement, and this is, you know, and I'm thinking, okay, but when somebody who's not a citizen and they don't actually qualify to vote is registered, and then if they end up voting, that's diluting, and that itself
exactly.
is disenfranchisement. You know, so this doesn't make any sense, all of their arguments against it. In just the last 30 seconds here, Paul Teller, really appreciate it. You should follow him at P Teller on X. Do you think that Republicans in both the House and the Senate will get it together to actually pass this?
I think so. It looks like it. Again, there could be a few bumps along the way, but I do think this is something that can get through, because, again, it's hard even for some Democrats in the end to vote for this and go home and explain to their constituents, even in blue states, yes, I think you should be able to register illegal aliens to vote. I mean, that's a tough one, even for many Democrats. So I do think this is something that that gets into law.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Paul Teller, for your insights. And we will definitely have you on again more as we continue on with this second term of Trump and all of the crazy news cycles, of course, that we continue to go through, and we will see how the tariff situation resolves itself. And coming up next, we want to focus on China, as they're kind of the outlier, and what does that portend for our trade relationship there, and where is Trump focused? So we will be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back, and we're continuing to talk about the whole tariff situation, the 90-day pause, but then, of course, Trump is treating China a little bit differently, but they're also treating America a little differently than maybe some of the other nations that are willing to talk and to enter into the art of the deal. So where is China, the CCP, in the whole tariff situation and kind of in the broader topic of, you know, what is going on in that framework? Well, Matt Palumbo is a writer at the Blaze and has actually a really great repository. If you go to theblaze.com and just look for all of his pieces, he's also the author of The Man Behind the Curtain, Inside the Secret Network of George Soros, and he joins us now. So Matt, good morning, and tell us all about China.
Good morning. Well, you know, it's going to be really a question of who blinks first here. So far, it seems like every single country is coming to the table, and these include countries far wealthier than China. So, you know, China's GDP per person is only about $15,000. Their economy is far smaller than ours, despite them having four or five times the population. So, really, they're a teller. So, you know, they are bluffing, and they are bluffing into the superior entity. So I do predict that they will probably cave at some point. And, you know, I do know some people that are being affected by this, by the high tariffs. But that is the point in the short term, is make it so no one's buying from China. And then China has no choice but to collapse or devalue their currency. But actually, their currency right now actually is losing value on its own. So it's not really looking great for them yet. And I mean, Hong Kong's stock market early was down something like 15% in a single day. You know, I don't consider them part of China, but they are part of China, unfortunately. So, you know, that's really all it is. And, you know, the EU just a couple of hours ago suspended all new tariffs. So if every single other country is willing to either drop tariffs or come to the table in some way, you know, I can't see China winning this in any way. It would be the first thing they won against us.
And I don't think that Donald Trump is planning to let that happen. And in fact, even just the other day when in talking about this, he was saying, you know, I don't think that China even knows how to go about this, but they'll get there. You know, they'll get there. I mean, almost grandstanding a little bit, or maybe poking the bear a little bit. And so what do you expect in the coming days from those types of conversations, and how China could potentially save face, but also, you know, work out a negotiation that Trump would actually go for?
Well, they're threatening us with things that are absurd. Like they were saying in response to Trump's tariff, they're no longer going to enforce intellectual property laws. And it's hilarious because there are thousands, if not tens of thousands, of businesses in China that are just knockoffs of American businesses. They are known for stealing trade secrets, corporate espionage. So they're threatening to do things that they're already doing to us. So, I mean, that's where they are on the bargaining table. But it is just a question of, are we going to wait this out with really high tariffs, or do they come to the table? Like I said, the risk of sounding repetitive. But I don't know. You know, Trump and Xi have some sort of relationship. There is going to be some sort of diplomacy between the two of them, I hope. And, you know, in the end, you know, the issue of tariffs is, you know, from an economics 101 perspective, they're not a good thing. However, if one country is imposing, let's say, a 20% tariff on us, that automatically puts us at a disadvantage. So we have no choice but to retaliate and put at least 20% one on them. Now, both having zero would be preferable to both having 20. And I think Trump's actual goal with tariffs is just for political purposes. But ultimately, you know, I think he wants a world of free trade and close to no tariffs.
And I'm speaking with Matt Palumbo, who is an author and also a writer at Blaze Media. So you can find all of his pieces at theblaze.com and then search under authors. And you have kind of a repository here of some interesting commentary about China as well, you know, beyond the tariff situation and, you know, some of the things that are more in the mainstream of the news. But this started, you know, back in March with this piece, Why Communist China is Terrified of a New York-Based Dance Company. And this is kind of, you know, continued on, I think, in some of your pieces. And this is a really fascinating story. So unpack Shen Yun, who they are, and what's exactly going on here as it relates to China.
Yeah, so they're a performance arts company, and I think I said in one of the pieces that whoever does their marketing definitely deserves a raise, because you see their signs pretty much everywhere. And my now wife and I think it was our first month of dating, went and saw one of their shows, and I liked it, and you know, I put it in the back of my head. I never thought it would be something I'd be writing about one day. But just a couple of months ago, I saw the New York Times had written some so-called exposés on it. And the one author in particular, I mean, there was a co-author, but the woman named Nicole Hong was the main author. It was the overwhelming majority of her articles from last year, since August of last year, were just fixated on this one thing. And I thought, all right, it's a little suspicious. And I looked into her history, and her father happens to work for two CCP-tied universities. He's part of China's Visiting Scholars Organization, which is part of the CCP and has been praised by President Xi. Now, back in 1999, China targeted a religion called Falun Gong, of which Chen Yun is associated with, for destruction. So they're going after any sort of linked entities. The website, the Epoch Times, actually is linked to them, too, part of a similar group. But then I started looking, too, into, like, what is the factual basis of their articles? And they were alleging mistreatment of workers, and some of them have actually spoken out to say it's just not true, which, you know, leads to the obvious question of how did that get into the article in the first place? Or they'll make sort of apples and oranges comparisons by arguing that their wages are lower than similar dance companies, but they're not factoring in other benefits, like, you know, basically getting free housing if you're part of a traveling group, or food, and, you know, those are non-cash benefits, but they were deliberately not accounting for them. So that's what I was going through, and then I also mentioned, you know, the New York Times actually has a very long history of whitewashing communism. There was a movie a couple of years ago called Mr. Jones about this, how the New York Times' correspondent in Moscow in the Soviet Union was denying in the press all the famines that were going on. And his source, like, his journalism was basically copying and pasting whatever Soviet authorities were telling him. And then a few years ago as well, China did so the New York Times did a series trying to offer a so-called alternative perspective on communism and romanticize it. And it was just, I mean, it was, I almost feel weird talking about it, but one of their arguments was that people were having better sex lives under communism. And I'm thinking to myself, like, all the people you're quoting are 70 years old. Like, I'm not trying to make it awkward, but, like, of course they would say that. They're all 20 back then. Like, it was just really bizarre arguments like that, or they liked the stability of it. And it's like, yeah, it's more stable, but you're also way poorer. That's the trade-off. So I don't know. I just thought it was a ridiculous series, and I couldn't find much factual basis for it, and I think they had some ulterior motives there.
That's a really interesting twist and tie to this dance company. And then the New York Times gets involved, and one of your pieces is then, you know, why is the New York Times carrying water for the CCP, and they're waging war now on this dance company, but is Beijing pulling the strings? And we've known for a long time that, you know, even though, like, as you mentioned, you know, rightly, Epoch Times and, you know, some of their ties to their investors and their owners and all that, obviously we always want to know, like, what's the source of funding, even for a reporter, because they will have some bias or allegiances that readers need to be adequately informed on. It's not like the New York Times just exists in their own bias-free vacuum, and we all know that. But the fact that the New York Times is getting involved in this, explain that, Matt, but also the question is, wouldn't they know that this would be transparent and not a really good look for them?
Well, the thing is, I don't think they were expecting anyone to really dive into it too much. It's almost an obscure topic, and I've actually only found one other writer who's spoken about this. But to also tie this back into what the CCP is doing, because they're doing much more direct, I mean, you can't call it activism, it's more terrorism. I actually did a separate piece on a website called Populist Times where I was talking about other sabotage tactics. And at the time I wrote the article, a couple of weeks ago, there have been 35 bomb threats against them to disrupt their organization. And if you look at the total number of bomb threats in the entire year of 2024, it was by February 20th that the 2025 number had eclipsed the entire 2024 number. And then 12 minutes later, after that happened, there was another bomb threat. So that has been one of the tactics. There was actually a man who was arrested carrying a gun outside of a Shen Yun event. China has been proven to pay influencers to go after the group. Tim Pool, who's very well known, said that they tried to pay him $200 to do an anti-Shen Yun video. And, you know, I've been to Tim Pool's house. He's going to need a heck of a lot more than $200 to do something like that. But, you know, if they're doing that to him, they're doing it to a lot of other people as well. And it's a coordinated attack, and it's obviously potentially could cause violence.
Yeah, wow, that's really interesting in this last piece that actually just dropped yesterday, talking about Tim Pool and how he shared how the CCP unsuccessfully tried to recruit him. This kind of gets into a little bit broader topic, even beyond the CCP, but when you have, when you have influencers, and I'm among them, and I'll be the first to admit that I've partnered, you know, with different, you know, organizations and other groups to promote values and positions that I personally agree with. And so, you know, everybody knows, for example, listeners regularly to this show know that I partnered with Vote No on 3 in the state of Florida to say, no, I don't think that we should legalize marijuana. I saw what happened to my home state, former home state of Colorado, when we did the same thing with Amendment 64, and it's bad, and I'm going to post regardless of whether I'm paid or not. But then if somebody wants to partner with me to get their message out more, you know, fine, as long as it's a position I agree with. But, you know, we're very open about all of those things. And yet we've seen that some influencers are putting out position standpoints. Like, there was this whole topic, you know, Matt, that I know you're very familiar with, of like Big Soda, and how, you know, some influencers were paid to post things that weren't necessarily their opinions. It was just based on a brief and some talking points. But users aren't necessarily, or followers aren't necessarily aware that this isn't their position and they're being paid for it. We're used to traditional advertising where everybody knows when you turn on the Super Bowl, you see the commercial, you know, Coke or whoever it is, they're paying for that advertising spot. In your mind, is there an ethical difference here with influencers, and especially when you have something like the CCP trying to recruit somebody like Tim Pool, who has a massive audience, when there isn't a disclosure? Like, to me, that's the ethical question.
Yeah, to me, it's way worse than when it's a journalist, because it's their job to be credible. When it's, you know, someone who's making TikTok videos, they're not disclosing that, I don't know, the coffee brand, you know, or drink in their videos is paid for. You know, that's just, you know, a much more low stakes thing. And also, it's not to go off topic, but you brought up the soda example, and I was researching for something else, and what the soda lobby, back when Michael Bloomberg was trying to ban large sodas for some reason, they were paying people like Al Sharpton to argue that it was racist because it would disproportionately affect poorer people who were disproportionately black because of the price increase. And it's like, the left just makes that proportional harm argument with everything, but it was just funny, like, the levels of desperation that some of these people will go to without disclosing in any way. Sorry to go up slightly off topic there.
Yeah, no, I mean, and I think that that's, but that's exactly, you know, what people need to understand and be informed of, is that a lot of these influencers that they're following are pushing positions that they are paid for, that they are framing, I think, intentionally, to say, you know, this is my opinion, then this is what you should think. And so they're framing it in a way that basically it is an advertisement, but without calling it that. So we're kind of in this whole new world, especially with what came out with people like Dave Rubin and Benny Johnson as well, you know, taking money and then, you know, claiming, of course, that they didn't know about Lauren Chin's ties and, you know, and all of these things, taking a lot of money to then, you know, push different guests and, you know, other things on their various shows. So, you know, this does become a bigger ethical issue. And how, and to kind of circle back into our original topic, how much of this has China, to your knowledge, successfully done? I mean, Tim Pool is raising the flag on it, and he's being public about it. But if they're going after him, definitely they're going after other large influencers as well. And full disclosure, I haven't been approached by China. So, you know, I guess I'm not cool enough like Tim Pool to, you know, be recruited.
Well, we know for a fact they have, you know, direct ties to that sort of thing with Tim Pool. They have bot armies on Twitter that are, you know, pretty easily provable to come out of China. But they also, with those bomb threats I mentioned, because, you know, you could ask the question of, like, well, how do you know they're from China? I mean, if they're about someone else. And since I published that piece, there was another one in Taiwan, which was the first one there, obviously a disputed territory that China claims. Again, in my opinion, not disputed. But they were all coming from Huawei, which is a Chinese-based company, and, you know, it sort of gives away where it was really coming from. As for others, you know, I should do an article on this, I guess, and just look at all the anti-Shenyun videos and try to see if, you know, there's a similar script. Because someone on Twitter put together a compilation of travel YouTubers showing off certain areas in China, and their language on certain things would be identical verbatim. So I guess I'm just making a note to self here. I should look into that.
Yeah, that'd be an interesting article. And when you publish that, we'll have you back on and talk about it.
Yeah, I'm writing one down right now.
Excellent. Well, so see for the listeners, this is sometimes how, you know, the brilliant ideas are generated just through your conversation about different topics. That's often how I get inspiration for articles as well. But, you know, but it is fascinating to look at how similar talking points are. And and we know that this happens even, you know, in the Republican Party, the Democrat Party in politics. I mean, talking points are very well known inside the Beltway, that everybody kind of gets the memo, hey, push this. And most people aren't creative enough or just take the time enough to change it a little bit so it's not as obvious that this is the exact same perspective, just like what the Democrats were doing right after Trump was inaugurated, and they were all talking about the price of eggs, like literally every single one of them. It's like, okay, somebody somewhere sent a memo to everybody, hey, let's focus on this, and we need to get, you know, this topic trending on X and all this. And so I think overall, though, the key takeaway message for listeners here to understand is that these things aren't just natural and spontaneous occurrences often. And so you need to be aware that what is trending is often intentional, and there are a lot of dollars behind that type of advertising to get things trending, even to try to have that semi-organically. I mean, there's a network of influencers on, you know, all kinds of different levels for various, you know, parts of things. And I'm part of some of those where people will send things to me and say, hey, please amplify this. If I think it's worthy, I will. And I'm not paid for it. But it's like, sure, we'll put this out into the ecosystem. You have to be aware, though, that this type of manipulation of the algorithm and of trending topics and then of the news media does occur. And so, Matt, as a writer and as someone who is on that side of it, but also obviously a reader wanting to expose this, how would you advise listeners to just be more aware of this? Because, you know, I don't see a problem ethically with, you know, trying to trend topics or boosting a friend's post that I agree with and all of those things to try to make that happen more or less, or maybe or not, or organically. But I think just the awareness factor is what's missing for a lot of consumers.
I mean, the number one to me, and this isn't always the case, some things organically go viral, but when something just appears to come out of nowhere and everyone is praising it as this great, shocking thing or whatever, there's usually something behind it. And sort of to what we were both saying earlier, when, you know, okay, suppose, I don't know, there's a new article out, new movie out from someone, et cetera. They will send out a script to the influencers. They'll give maybe 10 plus bullet points and say, tweak a few words. And most people are just lazy and basically take the exact same script. So you could even on a post just copy and paste the caption into Twitter and see if anything similar comes up there. Or look to, you know, one thing that happened to me that was funny was I wrote a series about George Soros, the New York Post, and their media person wrote a thread attacking me. And I don't know, she had maybe 3,000 followers, but the thing blew up. It got tens of thousands of likes on it. And I was going through the people who retweeted it, and it was like a who's who of all the people I criticized in the book. So it just made it obvious, okay, there was an email blast that went out that said we need to attack this guy because we didn't like his writing. But it's one of those things that, once you start seeing it a couple of times, it just becomes naturally easier to. It's kind of hard to explain like that, but if you see it once, you'll just pick up on it. Sort of the language they use is overly hyperbolic. Everything is, as I said, the most incredible thing ever, or the most damning thing ever. You just got to see it / read it, that kind of language.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the, oh, big bombshell, whatever, you know, that's one of the favorites. But we're almost out of time here, Matt Palumbo. But speaking of the Soros family, you have a brand new book coming out that I want you to just tease for our listeners. So I definitely want you to have you back on to talk more substantially about this, because it's going to be really fascinating.
Yeah, so the first Soros book was called Inside the Secret Network of George Soros as the subtitle. The subtitle on this one is Inside the Not-So-Secret Network of Alex Soros, because he just posts his entire life on social media. And I spent, I mean, countless hours, and I guess maybe this is slightly creepy, but it was for the purpose of research. I went through every single picture he's ever posted to try to map out what he's been up to, who he's been meeting with, what events are going on. There's just a ton of original research in the book, and it'll be called The Air, by the way. But one thing, for instance, people might find interesting is Alex has actually been funding the Soros DAs since 2022, which a lot of people probably didn't know because he took over in June of 2023, but he had assumed that role beforehand. So I have a whole chapter on the kind of people he's, you know, he was funding. In fact, he actually funded a prosecutor to run against a George Soros prosecutor that he didn't think was, I guess, loony enough. So that sort of tells you everything you need to know. And then one other thing I think viewers or readers would find interesting would be, it made a lot of headlines that he made about 30 or so visits to the Biden White House. My friend Joe Vasquez and I from the Media Research Center mapped out every single visit. We made a list of every single person he met with, including Biden at least once. And, you know, we talk about what happened that day prior, and it's just a lot of interesting, it correlates with a lot of interesting policy changes that I'll tease more in more depth once it's out.
Interesting. All right. Well, thanks so much, Matt Palumbo, and you can follow him on X to learn more about that book when it does drop at Matt Palumbo, P-A-L-U-M-B-O 12, at Matt Palumbo 12. And you can also read everything that he writes at theblaze.com. And we will be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. Will you take a moment and celebrate life with me? Last year, Preborn helped to rescue over 67,000 babies from abortion. Hi, this is Jenna Ellis, and I want to thank you for your partnership. Think about what you did. 67,000 babies are taking their first breath now because of you. Your $28 sponsored one ultrasound that was given to a woman as she was deciding about the future of her child. Once she saw her precious baby for the first time and heard their sweet heartbeat, her baby's chance at life doubled. But Preborn's mission is not only to rescue babies' lives, but also to lead women to Christ. Last year, Preborn Network clinics saw 8,900 women receive salvation. Your help is crucial to continue their life-saving work. Your caring, tax-deductible donation saves lives, so please be generous. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR, or dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Your love can save a life.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And as we're talking about the whole tariff situation, how China plays into all of this, we also need to talk about Trump's political capital and how he's spending a lot of it on tariffs. And is that really the best use of his political capital instead of, as we talked with Paul Teller earlier on in the program, you know, maybe going after some of these things like the SAVE Act or, you know, some of these balanced budget amendments that Governor DeSantis has been talking about. And so how exactly is Trump spending his political capital? Is this a good thing? Well, we do a deep dive once a week here on Demand. That is the name of my AFR exclusive podcast. And I just want to tease this out a little bit because this this program that is dropping today, you really need to listen to, because my guest is Mark Lauder, who was formerly in the Trump administration, then went to the Trump 2020 campaign, where he's a colleague of mine. He's now on Newsmax, but really has a wide depth of understanding of the political view of all of this. And so here is just a portion of what we talked about this week on Demand. And that's the important ingredient here, is time. And so that would eliminate the possibility of, you know, some of these countries just waiting him out and seeing if the approval ratings go down. But, you know, we saw in the Biden administration, he just didn't even care about his approval rating. It was so abysmal and just kept going. And I hope that, unlike the first term, I see there is a difference that Trump just doesn't care as much about media or about what the public is saying about him and, you know, some of that political capital as he did in the first term. And I actually think that's a good thing. I think that he's seen that, you know, regardless of what policies he enacts or doesn't, obviously the fake news media is not going to give him a fair shake no matter what. And the people who trust him are going to stay loyal no matter what. And then there's, you know, some people in between. Like, I think, you know, you and I at this point can critique fairly what we do and don't like, or what we would and wouldn't like to see. But overall, you know, we're 100% more for conservative policy than anything else, and very much wanting him to win. So is this going to be multifaceted from a political standpoint to say, okay, once he starts seeing some of those things improve, then he'll move on kind of to something else and change, or try to change, the focus and the attention onto, say, Congress or the judicial activists, or, you know, some other facet of his policy?
Well, the judicial activism one's a little bit different, but I do think, you know, going back to the economy real quickly, you know, again, not only do I think gas prices, utility prices, and those things matter, and they will affect his approval rating, but think about it this way as well. When he talks about the 70 countries that are calling, the 70 countries that are wanting to strike trade deals, I can imagine that he's going to have 70 different news conferences where they're going to sign some sort of an agreement when they get one. And each time another country comes off the board as being, oh, we're going to go reciprocal but fair and low tariffs, or we're going to go zero tariffs, or we're going to strike a good deal for both sides, the market's going to be buoyed. The news coverage is going to be dominated by whatever country happens to be signing today. We're already seeing Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, Australia wanting to make deals. So I think all of those things are going to set up to have a whole series of positive announcements, which the markets and others and economists will love going forward. As it comes to judicial activism, that's the tough one, because I think there's a little bit of give and take in terms of what Congress wants to do, what the judicial branch, meaning the Supreme Court, wants to do itself, and then what the White House wants to do. And so I think what you'll see, and I don't know, but what I would anticipate is that you will continue to have the White House keep the pressure on the judiciary. You'll still see Pam Bondi out there calling out activist judges. You're still going to see the Supreme Court in some cases, appeals courts in some cases, overturn a lot of these activist lefty judges who are making these rulings. But where we draw the lines, I think Congress does want to take a bite at the apple of reining in these judicial activists. And much like we would talk about sometimes, and I guess the best example I could use, think about the internet companies and the web companies. Whenever something happens, Congress threatens to regulate them, all of a sudden they find a way to self-regulate, so Congress doesn't have to get involved. I think Chief Justice Roberts, along with most of the conservatives on the court, would like to see themselves do this as opposed to having to rely on Congress to do it, because you're getting into the difference between, you know, the three branches of government. And so if I'm Chief Justice Roberts, if I'm Justice Thomas, Justice Alito, I'm sitting there going, you know what, it's better if we take a stab at policing ourselves, and maybe we can find the right case where the majority can issue an opinion, which then becomes basically, I'll leave it to your expert opinion, judicial law, which reins in some of these out-of-control judges in their nationwide injunctions, rather than Congress and the White House, the other two co-equal branches of government, coming in and telling us how we will do our jobs.
All right, if you want to hear the rest of that interview with Mark Lauder on demand, go to AFR.net, click on the podcast page for On Demand, and listen to that dropping each and every Friday on demand. And as always, you can reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net.